For those of you who were with me yesterday, I talked about a couple books in the bookstore. This is the one called Company Towns of the Pacific Northwest. They do not have extra copies, but she said they can order them. This is a store copy if you want to look through it. And it talks about company towns and compares by subject how different towns relate. And one of the things you'll find out if you read this book is that Holden was an outstanding company town. The other one that's of more interest, if you're interested in the operational end, is this copper book, which is primarily photographs that were taken by Larry Pemberthy, who hiked in from the West Side in 1938 after graduating from the University of Washington to get a job here, only to find out when he got here that the hiring was done in Chelan. They did, however, give Larry a job, and he worked here for, I think, 2.5 or 3 years as a chemist. But he had two hobbies, and he also climbed mountains, climbed trees, and took photographs of the village. So this is an excellent resource for pictures of around the village. The other thing I will mention is there is a DVD in the bookstore called Holden Mine Operations, and this is the slideshow that I will be showing and Rudy's narration of what you're seeing in it. And I'm hoping that I have most of the things accurate like he had them. I'm using his outline. So for those of you who haven't met me, my name is Linda Powell Jensen. I lived in the mining town as a kid from 1951 to 1955. I love this valley. All of us kids who grew up here will love this place. And we are so thankful that Holden Village is here, because most people who lived in mining towns as kids can only go back to a white spot of dust and road. And we have a beautiful home to come to. And we appreciate that very much. So I will start by telling you this guy that we're looking at is James H. Holden. Now, actually, it was in the 1880s that the Great Northern Railroad Company came through this valley looking for a route through the mountains to run their railroad to the coast. And they made notations in their documentation of observing mineral deposits. So there had been noted here. James Holden was born in Massachusetts in 1855, and he came west at the age of 19, and then ultimately ended up in Seattle, where he met Victor Denny in 1888. If you are familiar at all with the Seattle area, you will recognize the Denny name as one of the pioneering families of Seattle. Holden worked for the Denny family on and off for quite a few years, and in 18, trouble, we're up to another century already. The early 1890s, he would come over and set up camps for them on Lake Chelan, and they would do prospecting vacations. In 1896, he and Victor Denny were prospecting along the lake shoreline just above Lucerne, and Victor got called home on family business. So Holden actually came up in the Railroad Valley by himself, and in July, he was hunting, actually up on Copper Mountain, and while he was hunting is when he found the ore strike. He took some samples, he went out, had them assayed, and he filed a mining claim in his name only. The Denny family sued him, and the case went all the way to the Washington State Supreme Court, but Holden prevailed and became the sole owner of the mining property. Holden himself really wasn't interested in developing the mine. He wanted to make his money by selling it, but in order to do that, he had to have some materials. So he built a cabin and spent some time up here getting samples and developing it. He formed a Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company in 1899 and sold stock. And then he developed promotional materials. The first company to take a lease on the property was a company called Brennan Development Company. You can come on across, I won't mind. And Brennan came in and dug more tunnels, built a mining camp, and actually started work on developing a bed to run a railroad from the lake up to this area, because as I'm sure you can appreciate, the difficulty of getting the copper out of here was its location. Brennan worked on it for several years but decided not to do much with it. The second company that took a lease was a company named Granby, and they also did additional work in tunnels and additional work in the railroad bed. In the meantime, during this period of time, Holden had married Alma Lord, who was the daughter of a prominent Chelan rancher, and they had become very much part of the Chelan community. He was known as an industrialist. He was very involved in his church. He was involved in music. And their home no longer stands, but they had a very lovely home, and again, were very much part of their of the community. Holden would be in and out periodically working on trying to get the movement along to find somebody to buy this property. Granby decided not to buy, even though the reports were good. Holden needed money, so he got a loan from a banker named Crooker Perry, which is an interesting name for a banker. And he borrowed $7,500 from Perry in 1915. Holden died of cancer in 1918, and he still owed Perry money. So Perry sued Alma Holden and forced a foreclosure auction, and then he showed up and bought the property. He also was interested in selling it rather than developing it himself, and again worked with companies to try to get companies to lease. Granby showed interest again, but they didn't buy. There was an engineer that had worked for Granby by the name of Brennan, who had gone to work for Britannia Mining Company in British Columbia. And in 1928, Britannia took a lease. In 1930, they bought the property and formed a subsidiary, Halsall Mining Company, and started in 1931 to build in earnest. But the Depression came and work stopped. In 1936, they came back and work began in earnest. Almost all of the buildings in the mine and mill area and the town site were built in 1936 and 1937. Production actually started in 1937, and the first shipment of ore went out in April of 1938. The ore body itself is 80 feet wide and a half mile thick, and it goes at a slant down into the mountain. And again, you talk, one of the critical factors was getting it out of here. The other changes that were made at the time Halsall came was the trucking industry had advanced significantly. And the third factor was the decision to mill the ore here and not haul out the raw rock, because the ore was only 2%. So for every ton of rock, you were only getting 40 pounds of ore. So the milling process was critical to getting the development going. I would like to talk a little bit about the mining community. I guess I should say, it started production in 37, shipped in 38, and the mine operated for 20 years. By 1957, the ore body had run significantly low, the mill was worn out, and copper prices had dropped considerably, with copper mines opening up in South America. So in April of 1957, the company announced that July 1st would be the last day of operation. But during that 20-year period, this was a thriving community. You're familiar with the buildings here in town. The chalets were built by the company for management employees. However, the very early workers that came to work for Halsall in 1937, they had expected single miners and built all these wonderful dorms, the lodges you're now staying in. But they also hired a lot of engineers that were just graduating from college, and they were marrying their college sweethearts, who were not going to stay on the outside. So they started moving into the old cabins and bunkhouses up in the mining camp area, and that area became known as Honeymoon Heights because most of them were newlyweds. And for those of you who want to go for a little walk after I finish the presentation, we'll walk up the road and I'll show you where the ore body was, and we can go on up and I'll point out Honeymoon Heights and a little bit about the community. In addition to these, the miners who came to work with families started building homes up in what we call Winston Camp, you know, as Miners Village. And if you go out by the car vigil across from the Forest Service building, you'll see a rock wall. That's the start of the first house. There were 101 homes up there, and they were nice homes. They weren't mining shacks. They were equivalent to anything being built on the outside. And Holden was very much an all-American community. At the height of production, there were over 600 people living in Holden, so it was quite a big community. They had Boy Scouts, Campfire Girls, Bluebirds, Cub Scouts. The women had bridge clubs. The recreation hall was built by the company to have facilities for activities to keep people happy because they're isolated and they needed activities to do. The bowling alley, which is still the original. The pin setters have a motor added now to push them down, but those are the original pin setting machines. Bowling was very competitive, both men's and women's leagues, and they had junior bowling for kids. Our school had 8 grades. Once you graduate from 8th grade, you have to go somewhere to board out for high school. But we got an excellent education, and at the time the mine closed, there were almost 120 kids in the school in 8 grades. So again, it was a good-sized community. When the mine closed, they tried to sell the property, and they tried several times. In the meantime, a young man named Wes Preeb started writing letters to inquire about the property, thinking it'd be a good place. When Halsan was unable to sell the property, they donated it to the. They contacted Wes, sent him a telegram and told him to call and donate the property, which he then went to the Lubin Bible Institute, who knew nothing about his letters, and said, "What do I have for you?" Which is why we now have the wonderful Holden Village today. I'd like to give you some statistics about the mine, and then I do have handout sheets if some of you are interested. During the 20 years that it ran, the output was 10 million tons. There was 212 million pounds of copper, 0.6 million ounces of gold, 40 million pounds of zinc, and 2 million ounces of silver. And in terms of dollar volume, $70.5 million worth of copper, $21.5 million worth of gold, $5.5 million worth of zinc, and $2.5 million worth of silver. As far as the workforces, they worked 3 shifts during the busy years. And by the way, during World War II, the copper mine was so critical to the war effort that the men working in the mine were exempt from the draft. And there was a period of time during the war that they actually had soldiers up here working in the mine. In the higher production years, they ran 3 shifts, and there would be 100 to 200 men underground on a shift, another 40 men in the mill, and then 8 to 10 mechanics and so on the surface. The wages in 1931 were $5 to $6. By 1948, they were $10 to $12 a day. And by the 1950s, they were up to $15 a day. So again, the wages were very good. There are 58 miles of tunnel underground. There are 14 levels. The 1500 level, which we know as the village knows as the third level, was the main haulage tunnel, and it went back half a mile. And you will see a very crude diagram of what it looks like. During the high production, they were milling 2,000 tons per day and 600,000 to 700,000 a year. So. You're welcome to come in if you want.
Thank you. Come on in.
You're welcome.
Seat over here.
Can I sit here?
Oh, it's going to be a slideshow. This is just one picture, but I'm going to go slower. So that kind of gives you kind of a brief idea of the history. The road building that originally started out as railroad became railroads one way. By the way, the switchbacks didn't have jersey barriers on. And when you see the R trucks, you'll understand why our guys kind of chuckled when they got pictures of the jersey barriers. But anyway, at this point, I'll go ahead then and we'll do the slideshow of the mine operations itself. And I'll get my little cheat list out, but I'm pretty familiar with what most of the slides are. Where do I turn this? That box?
They're over here.
I think we probably won't want in on for the slideshow. And bear with me, this is a little awkward. Our museum presentation of this, we didn't have all this equipment. We only had a TV and a DVD set, so I have a manual advanced DVD. So I have to make sure I get my hand on the right button and remember to point it the right direction. That's what I'm gonna do. Now I've gotta get.
There you go.
That's what I want. We want the menu. We're going to go down to... Get it pointed the right direction. We'll go to that. Okay. There we go. Okay, this presentation starts with Lake Chelan, and as you can, I'm sure, appreciate, that was an integral part of them being able to get the ore out of here. Without the lake, I'm not sure they would have gotten it out yet. This is a picture of buildings that were at the third level, a winter shot, as you can tell by the icicles. The building on the left is where the machine shop was that took care of keeping the tools working, sharpening the drill bits. Up above that, the second story was the offices. The building in the center in the back is what we called the dry. That was the change house where the miners changed their clothes into their underground diggers, as they called them, to go underground and then change clothes and had showers when they came back out. This is a picture of the portal. Safety first. That sign was there forever, from the time it opened till the time closed. House Sound emphasized safety, and they had an excellent safety record. I have been asked about fatalities, and I've spent over 10 years trying to do research. I only am up to 17 names. They were all individual fatalities, and several of them, I don't have details of the accidents yet. So we really think there were probably less than 20 in 20 years, which is an excellent safety record. This is a picture of the footbridge that was in place during the mining days, the covered footbridge, not near as pretty as the one we have now, which I guess will be replaced before too long. This is a picture of what they call the man train, this little wooden train. This is the train the guys would get into to go underground to start their ship. It was an electric trolley-operated train, the engine. The fellow does not have his hard hat on. That's because they were taking pictures for documentation. I can assure you he would not be on that train and operating there without his hard hat. And by the way, that job was, the mine job was what my dad did. Come on in and sit down. I think there's some spaces over here. That was what my dad did when he worked here. He was the little train operator. This is a picture of a miner getting ready to go underground, and you will notice that he's holding a headlamp in his hand. In order to get that headlamp to put onto his hat, he had to turn in his brass to the lamp master, and his brass was put on the brass board. The brass was a round circle like this. If you ever go up in the little museum that's up at the corner of the village center, you'll see, I think there's three or four on display in the case. They're about this big around, they have a hole in them, and they have a number on them. That was his employee number, and it went on the board. When he came off shift, he turned in his lamp, and his brass came off the board. That's how they kept track of who was underground. So they always knew who was underground, and if anybody didn't come back out. Again, one of their safety things. By the way, all the employees had brasses, even the women who worked in the mess hall and the fountain lunch, all employees had a brass, but the main purpose of those brasses was to control the safety of the miners underground. Holden is a hard rock mine. The timbering only went back 100 feet. This is a picture taken at the very beginning of the portal. You can see that there is some timbering, and that's the little engine behind that car. Here's another picture back a little ways further, and all the pipes are there, but no timbering. I get asked about deaths from disease in the mine, hard rock mine. Sody died in February, 95. A lot of these guys are lived into the 80s and 90s. I was figuring out Sam Smythe must still be alive. I didn't get his newsletter back this spring. He's got to be 98. So no diseases as a result of the operations here. This is the third picture again of the tunnel back further. By the way, that guy's name was Denny Spurgeon, known as Casey Spurgeon was his nickname. He was my dad's partner. This is a picture of the skip, it was commonly known. This is the lift that was used to lift the ore up from the various levels to be hauled out. It could hold 85 cubic yards. This is a picture of the lift operator, and again, this picture is taken. It's why he's having his hat off. He would not be operating that equipment without his hat. And if you walk down the hallway in the hotel basement, you'll see one of the signs they have down there has bell signals on it. The bell signals was how the lift operator could identify where what level the guy was on or what level the ore was on that needed to be moved. This is a close-up shot of the lift operator. This is a very crude cut out of the mine, but it does show you, give you an idea of the tunnels and how it was structured. The three tunnels above, the top one is where the original ore discovery was. When Howsound started mining, they did the upper three areas is where the mining was done first. And then as they expanded the operation, the main haulage tunnel, and then the shaft went down, and the tunnels go back different lengths from the shaft. You'll also see a couple little side chutes that are in this diagram on the left side of the shaft. Those chutes were used to dump rock down to break it up into smaller pieces before it was loaded to be hauled out. This is a picture in the main haulage tunnel showing where it was divided to go into a separate area, and that points west. They had what they called an east drift that they were working on in the 1950s, and they were very hopeful that they were going to find another body of ore, but they did not, which also contributed to the mine closing because there was no new vein of ore available. These guys are the diamond drillers. They were the highest paid guys. They're the skilled. They're the ones that drilled the holes for the blasting. And you want to pass around a couple? These are the bits, the star drills that they used to drill holes. And this is what the machine guys had to work on to keep sharpened all the time. They would go through those. And like I said, this was one of the higher skilled jobs, the guys that did the blasting. This is a picture of them making holes down below to set the charges. The mining method used here is called stope mining, and it basically is done by blasting holes, and as you get the ore hauled out, you blast some more holes and worked up, and I'll show you a picture of a stope and give you an idea of how big it is. There's some pretty big holes in that mountain. This is another shot of them getting ready and getting their charges set. Putting the charges in. And waiting for the dust and the rocks to settle and quit falling. There's some room over here if you want to come over. You're welcome to come over. They had to wait a minimum of 15, usually 30 minutes to make sure all of the rock has settled. One of the fatal accidents that we had in the mine was a blasting accident. And unfortunately, like numerous of the accidents that I have documentation on and read, it happened because of a safety violation. They cut their fuses too short. This is a picture of the debris after a blast has been done. This is a picture of what they call a drag bucket. In the early years, all of it was done by hand. In later years, they had equipment like the drag buckets that could pull a lot of the debris out to a central area for loading into the ore cars. This is rocks being dumped down the chute from an ore car. They had side dump type cars that opened up to dump it down. Those chutes I told you again to break it down. And this is a mucker. That was the entry-level job, the guy that shoveled up the debris into the car to move it out to be lifted up and on its way to the mill. So one of the favorite Sunday dishes in the fountain was called the mucker special. It was bigger than a banana split. And one of the community dances in the early years that they held in the fall before the big New Year's dance was called the mucker's ball. That's a good picture of the side open cars with the rocks being dumped down. Some of these are from the earlier years and some from the later years. Here's a close-up picture of the skip with the ore on it. When the men were coming up out of the mine, they had a different type of platform they would put on the skip, and then they would ring their bell, and that was how they were lifted up to the surface, to the main haulage tunnel, another fatality was, which was really sad. The first night he was at work, a young 19-year-old didn't put the thing on properly, and when the lift started, he fell down the chute. This is a picture of it down below where rocks are coming down and into the ore car. This is a picture of the stope. And the stope is, my little lift, 800 feet high and 80 feet wide. And to give you a concept,
there's a person down there.
This is the person standing in the stope. And as I said, there are numerous stopes in that mountain. So there's some pretty big holes in there. You can see where there's a lot of water coming out. This is another picture of debris from a blast area. This is a picture taken in the lunchroom of some ship bosses. Guy on the left is named Robertson. Guy in the middle named Hipsher. His daughter was one of my best friends. And the guy standing is named Brewer. He and his wife were always called aunt and uncle by his kids. They were all longtime employees here. And I believe all three of them worked here till the mine closed and started in the 40s. This is another picture taken in the lunchroom, and notice the date on the blackboard, May 16th, 1957. And again, one of the guys has the hat off. As I mentioned, they made the announcement in April, and this picture was taken, and some of these pictures when they had someone come in to do photography documentation in May before the mine closed to get additional documentation. So this was the lunchroom where the ship bosses ate. I don't know that the miners came up for lunch in this room all the time. They may have eaten sometimes down where they were, depending on how far down they were. This is a shaft for the air ventilation system. And besides the main portal opening, which has been locked off for years, it was open for quite a few years after the village was here. It's amazing to me no one went down. But if you follow the road from the end of the switchbacks that goes down toward the ballpark, close to where the ballpark is located up at the mountain is another great big entrance and a big hole. And there was this giant fan, huge, big, round, orange fan that was an exhaust fan that ran all the time. And people ask, well, wasn't it noisy? Didn't it bother you? Well, it was a hum. But, you know, the only time you noticed it is if it ever stopped, because then it would become dead silent in the valley. So it wasn't really a bothersome thing. But it was a very interesting piece of equipment to see, because we could walk, there was a bridge up by the ballpark, and we could walk across that way and up past the fan and go up to Honeymoon Heights to pick black caps. This is another picture underground of a small tunnel that's being dug on the side of a stope. And this is a fellow, he's in checking for loose rock. Again, if they're getting ready to go in, you see as he gets there, he's checking to make sure there's no loose rock before they start shoveling. This is another picture from the very early years of the tunnel, and again, the safety first sign is still there. And this is a picture of the mill. And the mill operation was designed to start at the top and go to the bottom. You can see the trestle running. I regret that I don't have a pointer. And by the way, this is the size of the rocks as they came out of the mine. This is called chalcopyrite. Pass them around if you want. So this is what they look like when the ore car dumped them into the top of the mill. And again, you can see the trestle coming across. At the top of the mill were these pieces of equipment called the jaw crusher. And when the rocks came out of the jaw crusher, they were about this size. I don't know if you can see, but they about a little bit bigger than 50-cent piece probably. And they went through. From there, they went into what was called a cone crusher that kind of operated like a mortar and pistol. And the cone crusher, when the rocks came out of there, they were little pebbles. And the pebbles went into these giant round drums called the ball mills. And our dad took us up through the mill one time. Kids couldn't go over there, but if your parent took you, they had all these steps that went up through the mill, because in the wintertime, the guys going to work a lot of to the mine would walk up through the mill on the steps rather than going around on the road. The ball mills were really, really noisy. And this is what was in them. You don't hurt yourself. You can see why. So when those ball mills finished with the little pebbles, it was a fine powder that went out into flotation tanks. And to the flotation tanks, they added a chemical called Xanatax that caused the ore to rise to the top, and it would float off into a great big vat. And the ore in the vat, if you've been in village in past years before the mill disappeared, or the mill structure disappeared, and we're up in that area, you may have seen toward the bottom of that structure these giant round, two great big giant round vats. Those were the drying vats, and that's where the ore was dried. And then from there, it would be sent down a chute and loaded into the ore buckets. So it basically was an operation from the top down. The wastewater from the flotation tanks was then piped out to the tailings. This is another look at the mill taken when there wasn't snow. This is the wooden pipes, and you've probably seen a few pieces of these laying around in their historic one. I think they may have a small piece down by that ore car. These are the pipes that hauled the wastewater out from the tanks into the tailings pile. And they used a dike system to pump it out and move the pipes back and forth to fill them evenly. The fellow on the right was one of the ore truck drivers. His name was Hoggett. I knew the family well. Actually, I babysat the kid who was in the left, in the blue shirt, who was younger than, obviously, his son in the middle there. And Earl brought some good pictures of ore trucks. These are the trucks they drove. Each of those three barrels has 5 tons of ore. So they were driving 15 tons down those rows, winter, summer, and no radio transmission. And there were fewer turnouts than there are now.
It was a lot narrower, too.
It was a lot narrower. It's been widened considerably, of course, this last couple of years. But they ran winter and summer, and like I said, 15 tons. But they, you know, they had their own way, knowing by timing of when it was loaded and what their normal round trip time was where they were. During the summer, of course, you could watch for the dust. And during the summer, people who had their cars up here could also use the road, but they had to watch for the dust, and they better not be on the road when the truck came, because it was their responsibility to be off on a turnout. And as far as I know, they only lost one truck, and it was lost on the switchbacks. The brakes went out. And I don't know how much ore was lost, because I don't know, they don't show anymore, but they actually had runouts at the end of the switchbacks where a truck would go. Critical part of the operation were the transportation guys who had to keep the roads open. The house that we bought when we moved here had a garage with it, because the guy that had the house before us worked on the transportation crew, and he had a Jeep, and in the wintertime, if the snow started in the night, they got up and started. So the road had to be kept open. That's a picture of the dock, which is in the same location as Holden Village's dock, but this dock was much longer and had the track with the crane on it. The crane would lift the buckets off the truck and load them onto the barge. And the barge would head on its way. I'm trying to remember if it was 14 hours or something like that one way. And if there was personal items or coming in or out, if you had your car coming in or going out, or like they are moved in, my mother was down there when they unloaded our truck. Personal items sat on pallets on top of the ore trucks and rode up and down the lake. So she was very unnerved when she watched them pick up her entire wholesale and swing it over the water and land it on sitting on the ground. This couple's name is Barquist, and they were back visiting and took a picture, and they were actually considered the original Honeymoon Heights couple because they were here in 1931. He was in charge when they started the building in 1931 and then left when it closed down until the Depression years improved. This couple is named Ruth and John Bly. John was mine superintendent for quite a few years. He and his wife have done a recorded interview that they talked about life on Honeymoon Heights. One of the things you ladies might appreciate, the fact that she said when they ordered things out from Safeway, if they didn't have what you had on your list, they knew you needed something. So she said, you never got back a list without a stock. They sent you something. It might not resemble what you ordered, but you had to. They were very good about that. And they were here for several years. John also told some really nice stories when he came back to reunions. And I'll take a minute where I think we're doing okay time-wise. He told us a story about when D.A. Rogers was building his house, which was on the first row, and he had 10 kids. They had a three-story house. He had a big rock in his basement. So he kind of borrowed a piece of dynamite from the company. And John was on his way up to the mine, and he heard this big boom and saw smoke coming from Winston Camp, and he went up. And D.A. had got the rock out of his basement. John said, of course I was supposed to fire him for stealing the dynamite. But he said, I went upstairs, and Anna had just finished canning pickles. And all of the jars of pickles were exploded all over the house. And the handle of the vacuum cleaner was lodged in the bedroom. And he said, I looked at Anna and I thought about all those kids, and D.A. didn't get fired. But he's one that also talked about at the reunions about the fact that this was a very state-of-the-art operation here. There were mining methods embedded here, and he talked about the fact that some of the things were invented were because of the union and management people working together. He also said that the company probably ran over a year to a year and a half longer than it might have otherwise because the management and craft people in the mill figured out ways to keep the mill going somewhat efficiently. So he had very high remarks. The other thing is that they did have mining people come from all over the world to look at this operation. This is a picture of Chalet Hill. A lot of trees there now, but this was taken at the end because there are TV antennas there, and there were a few TV people getting TV toward the end. And my understanding is the engineers that lived in the chalets here actually had a big giant antenna reflector somewhere and had a little cable system running between their chalets. But the house went with the position, and the higher up you were, the further down the hill you lived. The big one at the bottom was the general manager's house. The second chalet, which burned not too long after the village acquired the property and has since been replaced, was a guest house and was used for house-hound dignitaries from the New York office when they visited and for people that came from other parts of the world. The third chalet, which was pretty good size and I guess had multiple bathrooms in it, unlike the others, when the village came, was for single management employees. And from there on out, the house went position, and over the years, sometimes the position changed as far as who was assigned to the house. But if you got a promotion, you might move three or four houses down the hill. This is a picture of the town site in the mining days. Not a lot of differences, although you will notice on the left, that second building, which is the building we're in right now, was just a dorm in the mining days and didn't have the beautiful porch. The next building down, where the carpenter shop is, that little porch sticking out on the back was the loading dock for the grocery store. We did get a grocery store in Holden in 1947. It was not a company store. This was a very good company town. They controlled it tightly. And they contracted out the grocery store. You read about company towns where they kept the employees in debt to the company store so they couldn't afford to quit and go get a job somewhere else. That wasn't true in Holden. I also would mention that this was an alcohol-free town. They tightly controlled it. You couldn't buy it here. You could have alcohol in your personal space, and there was a tavern at Lucerne, but no alcohol was ever served at public functions. And you couldn't purchase it here in town. The little building beyond on the left was the firehouse where the fire truck was. Unfortunately, it collapsed early on after the mine closed. The village center, as you called it, we called the rec hall. They built that rec hall to have a lot of activities for people to do, and the gym was very much multifunctional. I'm not sure if this is a picture of a meeting or if it's a picture of the start of the dance, but I don't see an orchestra. They had dances here, which was one of the few times. It must be a dance because the floor is bare. If there was a meeting, there would be canvas on the floor. We couldn't walk on it. They had basketball there during the winter. Teams came from the outside to play against company teams. And in the late 1930s, the team from Holden actually was the Washington State amateur basketball champions. It was also where the kids' programs were put on. They had a community Christmas tree. If you come to my Thursday program, you'll see pictures from that activity. But again, that the village, the rec hall, was built to have the facility to keep it that. The pool hall was a little bit different in the mining days. There were, it was for 21 and over, and instead of, there were pool tables, but all the other tables were poker tables. And by the way, you're sitting in the chairs from the poker tables. This is a picture of the bowling alley, and as I had mentioned, it was a very much popular sport, very competitive. The little daily newspaper carried the standings weekly of who was on top. This is a picture of Winston Camp. There were 101 homes up there, and they were built in rows. There was a bottom row with houses on one side, middle row with houses on both sides, and top row. The top row and part of the bottom row had breaks where there were no houses because there were very wet spring areas. But they were, as you can see, they were nice-sized homes, and they were small, they were compact and efficient. This is a winter shot, and because people ask me periodically, I will show you. This is my house right here. This is a picture of the middle row, and this is in the last edition, what we call the new edition. These were built in 1949. Most of the others were completed in the early 40s. The interesting part is the ones that were in the new edition that were built later weren't built as well. They were the first ones to start collapsing. And by the way, that house on the right above the cement wall, that was where that ore truck driver lived. This is a picture that you see up by the car bridge, and that three-story house in the center is the one where the guy set off the charge, dynamite charge. The little building on the left is the garage that was across from our house. And the rock wall is still there. That's the landmark. In fact, there was discussion at the table I was at dinner tonight that they need to get the Forest Service to let them take a couple of trees out that are breaking that rock wall, because that is basically a historic artifact now, that rock wall, because it is the start of Winston Camp. And just this side of it is the Forest Service cabin, which, by the way, in the mining days was the Campfire Girls meeting cabin. We had our own meeting cabin, and the Boy Scouts had a beautiful log cabin at the other end of the village. This is a picture of the middle row in wintertime, give you an idea what the snow was like. This is keeping the road open to Lucerne. Hurry up here, I'm running out of time. This is the favorite sledding hill. The big kids liked a different one that went longer, but this is the short one. And if you walk out toward the ballpark, this is the last hill that goes up into the village from the bottom road. But that was a popular sledding hill. There's a picture of the spring that is starting to melt, a little bit of the wall showing, but the sled's by the front door. And you'll see clotheslines on the porch. Most of the clothes were hung from either a high porch or a second-story window on a pulley line. And skiing was very, very popular, and we had a rope tow. And that ski area was located at the top west end of Winston Camp. And they had a big pole with a wheel on at the bottom and a motor on a toboggan that when there was enough snow, they took it up and started it up and skied all winter. These are cars sitting down at Lucerne. I mentioned that people could have their personal cars up here during the summertime, but you couldn't keep them up here in the wintertime. First of all, there would have been too much snow on them, and secondly, they had to be off the road for the snowplows out of the way, so everybody would take them down to Lucerne and park them and disconnect the batteries, and there they'd sit till spring. And this is why you needed a car in the summertime. To get to Lucerne, to the tavern. There was a tavern down there. That is a dog, by the way. It's not a bear. That's a question we usually can ask. We also went down there for swimming and picnics and such. Swimming was not allowed in the creek, although the older Boy Scouts had a secret swimming hole, but children could not go near the creek. And this is a picture of the third level after the mine closed and they'd started dismantling, but it has a gorgeous picture of Bonanza in the background. And this picture of the assay office was put in as part of the program because the assay office was where the original museum was built. They used the foundation from the assay office to build the museum that Rudy started, which of course is no longer there with all the changes that have taken place. But it was a good start. We do have a lot of artifacts, and hopefully before too long we'll have a new museum. And there are a few items on display up in the balcony corner of the Village Center, including some of Penrith's photos are up there, and a few other artifacts to see. It's pretty limited, but you can get a little bit of flavor. And then we will end with the Sun Over Bucks for Bonanza. So basically, that's a little bit of what the mine operation looked like. Again, I emphasize Helen was a great place. It was a wonderful community. It was a good mining operation. I know it left behind debris, but there's no toxic waste out there. It's all natural minerals. I do like to remind people, unlike other places, there was not a toxic chemicals used in processing and left behind. So, and all of us who lived here in the mining days love this place. If you didn't, you didn't stay. And the kids who grew up here loved it. We had an excellent education. Our teacher died a few years ago at the age of 105. She taught her 20 years, or 18 years, I guess. But anyway, so it was a great place to live. It was a good company. And for those of you who are interested, I'll answer any questions. And then if anybody wants, I will walk up the road and point out on the hillside where the ore body was found, as best we can see through the trees are getting grown up. And I can also walk onto Winston Camp if you want. But anyway, that concludes the formal show.